Good evening, and it's a real pleasure to be here. And it's great to follow Norman Finkelstein, who's always so thorough in his exposé of the historical record in international law. And that saves me a lot of work. And I want to talk about really starting from Gaza and what it means and how we put it in context and how we think about the future. What Israel did in Gaza in December and January is part of a long history. Palestinians can recite the names of the previous massacres, starting from the terrorist bombings of the Zionist militias in Mandate Palestine, when the Zionist movement introduced modern terrorism to the Middle East, when Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir and other members of the Stern Gang and Lohamei Herut Israel and all the other pre-state militia organizations would strap bombs to donkeys and set them off in Palestinian marketplaces. Of course, the bombing of the King David Hotel, the assassination of the UN envoy Count Volker Bernadotte in 1946. These are the origins of modern terrorism in the Middle East. Then, of course, the massacres in Deir Yassin, Qibya, Kfar Qasim, and so on, Sabra and Shatila, Jenin, all the way, Qana, of course, all the way up to Gaza. And this is just a sampling. The lists of massacres run into the dozens. Now, why does Israel keep having to massacre Palestinians? Of course, we know the Israeli narrative. It's drummed into us. These Palestinians, are terrorists, and they just refuse to let Israel live in peace. And we've reached the stage where the demonization and dehumanization of Palestinians in particular, and Arabs and Muslims in general, and this is something that is not exclusive to Israel, but also takes place in and by the United States, it's reached a point where we are told that Israel can bomb homes. More than 4,000 private homes were destroyed in Gaza. 17,000 were damaged. Where it can bomb schools, universities. We're here in a university. If we were in Gaza, we could be bombed. Israel bombed the Islamic University of Gaza, destroying its facilities, educational facilities, which, by the way, had been partly built with funding from the United States and a great deal with funding from the European Union. We're often told that, these Palestinians, they're Muslim fanatics and they're barbarians and they don't know civilization and all these other kinds of lies. Of course, the Islamic University of Gaza, which educates 18,000 students, 60% of those students are women. And in fact, the majority of university students in Palestinian society are women, and they study everything that you study here, from pharmacy to engineering to English literature to Arabic poetry, the whole range of things, because they have exactly the same aspirations as you have. So Israel bombed universities. It bombs places of worship. Factories, more than 900 factories and workshops were bombed by Israel in 3 weeks. It bombs police stations. Believe it or not, Palestinians, like everyone else, need police to keep order in the streets, to solve crimes, to regulate the flow of traffic. And Israel bombed virtually every police station in the Gaza Strip. It even bombed a graduation ceremony of dozens of young police officers, traffic police officers. It bombed fishing boats. It bombed ministries. It bombed the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Higher Education, as well as a whole complex of government buildings were reduced to rubble. They had already, in a previous round of bombing, destroyed the Foreign Ministry and several other buildings. They bombed the Palestinian Legislative Council building in Gaza and destroyed it completely, the home of the only democratically elected legislature in the Arab world, reduced to rubble. All of this is done, and I maintain that it is the demonization of Muslims and Arabs and Palestinians that allows Israel to argue that all of this is a war against terrorism. Now, this massive destruction, the massacres, and Norman already talked about that in terms of the use of banned weapons and the targeting of civilians, was supposed to do a couple of things. It was supposed to, as Norman said, there wasn't much of a war. There was resistance. There was fierce resistance. Palestinians resisted with the means they had at their disposal. They didn't simply abandon the field. They fought with what they could, which wasn't much. And they defended themselves the way any other community that is under such attack would defend themselves, with the means at their disposal. And they had a right to defend themselves. They had the right to self-defense, and they exercised it. But more importantly, what this massive attack, Israeli-style shock and awe, was supposed to do was to break the will of the population, to get the population to turn against Hamas and to turn against those they had elected in 2006, because the boycott, the siege, the US-backed attempted coup by the militias of Mohammed Dahlan failed. So they thought, well, we'll go after the population. This is classic terrorism. If you look at the US definition, official definition of terrorism, it says, there are several, but if you take the one from the FBI, it says that terrorism is the use of violence or the threat of violence by sub-state groups to against the civilian population or a government to achieve political ends. Now, of course, we put in the caveat that it's only by sub-state groups. That's so that we can't accuse states of terrorism, because otherwise we have to admit that most of what states use their military for is terrorism. It's to terrorize civilian populations, to pressure their governments, or to overthrow their leaders. And the blockade is another form of terror against the civilian population for political purposes. John Kerry went to Gaza recently, and he discovered that Israel was allowing some food through the blockade, rice, but not pasta. And Israel said that's because pasta is not a humanitarian need. Now, who in this room, is there anybody willing to stand up and give a justification for distinguishing between pasta and rice? I mean, this is just an example of the totally arbitrary, totally cruel conditions Israel is imposing on Gaza. And prior to the attack on Gaza, Israel had been waging a silent war, against the people there. Mustafa Barghouti, one of the highly respected Palestinian physicians in the West Bank, who runs the public health committees, said, his organization said, that in the months prior to the December 27th attack, 262 Palestinians had died in the Gaza Strip. 262 had died in the Gaza Strip as a result of shortages of chemotherapy drugs, dialysis supplies, antibiotics, the whole range of medicines that Israel was not allowing into the Gaza Strip. And this Of course, Israel as the occupying power is legally required not only to let medicine in, but if there is a shortage, to supply it. Israel as the occupying power under the Fourth Geneva Conventions is required to ensure that the civilian population under its control has sufficient supplies of food, water, medicine, medical care, and so on. And not only was Israel failing to do that, it was actually preventing food and medicine reaching the civilian population with the calculated intention of harming them. I look forward to the day when those who gave the orders for withholding food and medicine are brought to justice in an international court of law. I look forward to that day, and I do believe that that day will come. Now, all of this was designed to break the will of the population. And the purpose, I think, was clear. There were a couple. Israelis talked about restoring their so-called deterrence, which they lost after they failed in a similar war on Lebanon in 2006. They failed to break the resistance. They failed to break the will of the Lebanese people. And having failed to crack Lebanon, they thought they would go after a weaker target and achieve that there. They failed to do that. But the idea was that with Hamas and other resistance factions removed or fatally weakened, Israel would be able to sign a peace treaty with Palestinian collaborators who would manage the Palestinians on Israel's behalf. That was the goal, and that was the idea, to have a situation similar to what is in the West Bank, where you have a so-called Palestinian Authority, which is entirely supported and dependent on Israel, repressing Palestinian resistance, repressing Palestinian protest against the occupation. Hamas is what stands in the way of that, and that's why they wanted to destroy it. Now, paradoxically, this war, which was supposed to destroy Palestinian resistance, which was supposed to reduce the Palestinian people to submission, to bring them to their knees, not only failed to do that, but I think that it actually showed that it is not the Palestinian people who cannot survive, but it is Israel as a Zionist state. It is Israel as a state that grants special and superior rights to one group of people based on arbitrary characteristics, their membership in a particular ethno-national group. That is what cannot and will not survive in the Middle East. I'm not saying that Israeli Jews as people will not survive. Far from it. I think they will, and I think they can flourish. But what cannot survive is a state that provides special and better rights to one group of people. Now, we went briefly over the history. Norman went over that. Israel was created, and this is uncontroversial now, through ethnic cleansing. Simple numbers, you know, without knowing all the intricacies, on the eve of the creation of the State of Israel, the population of Palestine, Israel, of historic Palestine, what is today Israel, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, was 2 million people. Two-thirds of them were Palestinians, Muslims and Christians, and one-third of them were Jews, the vast majority of whom had arrived in the previous two decades. How could you establish a Jewish state in a country where the vast majority of the population was not Jewish and did not want to live in such a state? You had to physically remove that obstacle, that population. The problem is that the Palestinians did not just melt away. They did not accept their fate. They did not accept the partition of their country. And Israel, for 60 years, has been telling us that it is a Jewish and democratic state, that it is a paragon of liberal virtue like us. Well, the Jewish majority that exists within Israel's 1948 borders. There's actually a map, if you scan this, just a general regional map, not that one, there's a third one, yeah. That within the gray area, Israel's 1948 borders, the Jewish majority has been maintained by force, through force against three groups of Palestinians. The Palestinians inside the country, I mean, let me just step back a bit. Today, you have 11 million people living in this country. Half of them are Israeli Jews and half of them are Palestinians. So 60 years after the initial ethnic cleansing, the Palestinian population is now on the verge of becoming a majority again. In other words, the ethnic cleansing created tremendous suffering. It created an enormous refugee population. But over the long term, it failed to secure what the Zionist movement wanted most, a Palestine free of Palestinians. Now, the Palestinians in the country and the Israeli Jews do not fall into neat, homogeneous blocks that you can just parcel off into separate states. Within Israel, there are 1.5 million Palestinians. These are the survivors and descendants of the ethnic cleansing of 1948, who nominally have Israeli citizenship. I say nominally because although they can vote in Knesset elections, they have inferior rights legally, socially, economically, and educationally, culturally, in every possible way. In the West Bank, you have now 500,000 Israeli Jews living in settlements throughout the area. And even inside Israel, Palestinians and Jews don't fall into neat blocks. They have proven to be inseparable, unpartitionable. Norman talked about an international consensus about Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip and a right of return. I absolutely agree with that. But an Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, although absolutely necessary for a just and peaceful solution, is insufficient. Because if the purpose of creating a Palestinian state is to allow Israel to remain a racist state within secure and recognized borders, it cannot succeed. I think that what will happen is pretty much what Avigdor Lieberman, the rising star of Israeli politics, has said. He said, what's the point of a two-state solution? What's the point of a two-state solution if we end up with a Jewish state that's not fully Jewish? If we end up with a Jewish state where we still have 1.5 million Palestinians living among us? And he's absolutely right. The Zionist movement will not accept that. And I would expect that if a Palestinian state were created in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, that we would then begin to see overt and covert ethnic cleansing of Palestinians inside Israel. That is a likelihood that is not widely discussed, but I think it would be the logical consequence of the creation of a Palestinian state. Now, going back to... So we're in a situation today where, despite decades of... despite the original ethnic cleansing, despite decades of efforts by Israel to keep Palestinians out, to stop refugees from returning home, to limit the growth of the Palestinian population by not allowing construction, by not allowing Palestinian towns and villages, whether inside Israel or in the occupied territories, to grow, by making economic livelihood for Palestinians impossible so that Palestinians will be forced to emigrate. Despite all of these policies, Israel faces a crisis today because Jews living under the control of the Israeli... because in all the territory under the control of the Israeli government, Jews are about to become, if they are not already, a minority. And this is where Gaza comes in. If you go back to the map of Gaza, please. Gaza today, we often talk about Gazans. We often talk about Gazans, and I think it's a misnomer. Because 80% of the Palestinians in Gaza are not originally from Gaza. They are refugees from towns, cities, and villages that are now inside Israel. And simply, even if Israel were to open the borders with Gaza, to end the occupation, to lift the naval blockade, to lift the air blockade, it would not lead to a peace, because those 80% of the population still require justice and are still looking for their right of return. But Israel is very clear that it will oppose. We're often told that that Israel, or that everyone, that the moderate Israelis, now today that includes Tzipi Livni and even Benjamin Netanyahu, according to current standards, would support or should support a two-state solution. And that that any other kind of solution is unviable and off the table because it would be opposed by the vast majority of Israelis. What I would argue is that Israel has no preference for a one-state solution or a two-state solution. Now, that might surprise you. What I would argue is that Israel will oppose and has opposed in word and in deed a two-state solution that would in any way threaten Israeli domination or control over the land and its people. At the same time, Israel will not oppose a one-state solution. It will not oppose a one-state solution that guarantees Israeli-Jewish domination. In other words, it's not about the number of states, it's about equality. Israel will oppose any solution that gives Palestinians equality. What does equality look like? Equality is a full end to the occupation of the territories of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, full equality and citizenship for Palestinians inside Israel, and a full right of return for Palestinians in the diaspora. That's what equality looks like. And that could be achieved in any number of ways. It could be achieved with a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, plus a democratic state in what is now Israel. It could be achieved with a single state. It could be achieved with some kind of binational state in the whole territory. But the issue, ultimately, is equality. And the siege of Gaza is about preventing equality. It's about maintaining an artificial Jewish majority inside Israel so that Israel can continue to claim that it is a Jewish and democratic state. What does that look like? We create a Jewish majority through forcing out the indigenous population, and then we keep voting ourselves into power. If we have 80% Jews and they vote to elect themselves all the time, we call that a democratic result. It is not, that kind of situation is not in any way democratic. Now, in 2005, Israel polled its settlers out of the Gaza Strip and imposed a total blockade, a total siege on Gaza, turning it into a giant prison. One of the architects of this policy was a professor from the University of Haifa, a good reason why we should support the academic boycott of Israeli universities because of their participation in these policies. Arnon Sofer, an Israeli professor, who was an advisor to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon at the time Israel was planning this so-called disengagement or unilateral separation from the Gaza Strip. And in an interview in the Jerusalem Post in May 2004, Sofer said that Israel had to separate from Gaza as soon as possible. But he said, this separation, and I'm quoting, doesn't guarantee peace. It guarantees a Jewish Zionist state with an overwhelming majority of Jews. And he predicted that in the future, when 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, I'm quoting again, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will become even bigger animals than they are today, with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. The pressure at the border will be awful. If we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill, all day, every day. And he goes on in the interview to say that eventually Palestinians will become so fed up that they will beg for what he calls conflict management talks, not peace talks, but simply conflict management, which is what Israel is trying to do now. You give up your resistance and we'll let food in. That's the kind of situation Israel wants to impose for the long term. Or he said that Palestinians will give up and they'll leave, they'll go to other countries to look for their fortunes. Now, is Israel prepared to kill and kill and kill all day, every day? I think we got the answer in Gaza, and the answer is a clear yes. And the question is, I mean, for me, the conclusion is that this is the logical end of where Zionism has reached. If your goal is to have an ethnically exclusive state in a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious society, and if it's to do it against the will of the majority of the people, against the will of the indigenous people, then you must engage in massacres. You must be prepared to engage in massacres regularly and on an escalating basis. Because if the indigenous population continues to grow in numbers, and if it refuses to submit, if it continues to resist, then you must massacre them with ever greater force. This is exactly the logic that Arnon Sofer was admitting. And the Zionist leadership, the Israeli leadership, has made clear that it is willing to do it. Now this reminds me of another situation, a similar situation. Again, Norman pointed out the passage of time, that those of you who are undergraduates may not have even been born or may have been very young during the time of the anti-apartheid movement on American campuses, the struggle against South African apartheid, where you had a white minority regime, a settler regime, ruling over a black indigenous majority. And worldwide there was an anti-apartheid movement, a boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign. And in 1989, F.W. de Klerk came to power in South Africa in the whites-only election, and he was considered to be something of a reformer. And one of the first things he did is he brought his generals around him and asked them, how long can we hold on to power? How threatened are we? And they told him, you know, basically, in terms of military might, we are unchallenged. Nobody can force us out with physical force. And indeed, South Africa had the most advanced armed forces, it had nuclear weapons. Incidentally, it's a topic for another day, but South Africa was under an international arms embargo, and most of its weaponry, its air force, its navy, its ground forces, were armed by Israel. That's another history lesson, that Israel was one of the only states in the world that was prepared to break the arms embargo and arm apartheid South Africa. So the conclusion was, we can do this. We can last another 10, 20 years or beyond. But we are going to have to kill tens or hundreds of thousands of people. That will be the cost. And they realized that what the cost of that would be, not only that they didn't think they could do it, but that the world wouldn't let them. And the internal cohesion of the white society would not hold up. So that's really the question. It's not whether or not Israel is willing to do it, but whether the rest of us are willing to let them. As long as Israel feels that it can get away with what happened in Lebanon in 2006 or what happened in Gaza in 2009, it will continue and it will escalate. But it doesn't have to. What South Africa showed is that a paranoid settler society, which is convinced that if it doesn't act in the way it's acting, that it will be annihilated, that it can actually change. And I'm convinced that with sufficient external pressure in the form of boycott, divestment, and sanctions from international civil society, Israelis too will find their F.W. de Klerk, and they will be willing to negotiate their way out in a reasonable way. And I think that we've reached a point where the Zionist movement has lost the political argument. It has lost the moral argument. All that it has left is brute force. And it is not sustainable in the face of a global campaign. Israelis have to be made to recognize that the policy of trying to bomb their enemies into submission cannot work. For the first 40 odd years or 30 odd years of Israel's existence, they thought that worked. Israel had defeated almost every Arab army combined. But it stopped working after the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and then the first Palestinian uprising in 1993, the second uprising in 2000, Lebanon in 2006. I think that's me, but I have my stopwatch going. I'll put it here. And then Gaza 2009. What we've seen is that Palestinians and other Arabs have not only grown progressively less terrified and terrorized by Israel, but they have also grown more capable of resisting. Resisting militarily, even though it may be modest compared to Israel's capabilities, but resisting culturally, politically, in terms of social cohesiveness, and so on. Now, I think in just a few minutes, I want to talk about the politics of the moment, because I think we're at a moment of tremendous opportunity if it is seized. I agree with Norman that the day the Israelis decide to negotiate, they will find ready partners, and that's always been the case. I think that Hamas, since before it was elected in 2006, up to this day, has offered truce after truce. It's offered Israel a long-term truce. Every time Hamas has agreed to a truce, it has stuck to it. And on every occasion, those truces have broken down because Israel violated them. And those offers still stand from Hamas. I think that places like South Africa and Northern Ireland show that conflicts which were called intractable, which people said, where the conventional wisdom was, there is no solution. The hatred is too deep. The violence is too intense. The history is too long. Can be resolved. And they can be resolved provided we admit one principle, that all the people who live in a land must be given equality, must be given equal rights. It is a non-starter to demand of Palestinians, as Israel and the United States do, that they accept Israel's so-called right to exist as a Jewish state. Because what that is saying, in effect, is that Palestinians are recognizing the right of Israel to discriminate against them. And no people can do that. It's also ludicrous to demand that a stateless people that has been dispossessed, that is struggling for survival, recognize the legitimacy of the entity that not only dispossessed them, but has no declared borders of its own, and is now, as we speak, engaged in efforts to displace them further from their land and colonize it. By what right does anybody demand that Palestinians recognize the legitimacy of Israel under such circumstances, when Israel does not recognize any legitimate Palestinian rights, when it does not recognize international law? Let's talk about violence. We're told that Hamas has to renounce violence. We're never told that Israel has to renounce violence. In fact, we've reached a situation where the Palestinians under occupation, using the limited means they have to defend themselves, when they see their land being eaten up on a daily basis, are not only denied the right to defend themselves, they're told that bringing in weapons is smuggling, and not only are they denied the right to defend themselves, but their use of violence is actually interpreted or reinterpreted as aggression. That they're not only under occupation, but they're actually the aggressor. And just in the past couple of weeks, Israel announced that it plans to demolish the homes of 1,500 Palestinians in East Jerusalem, in Silwan, in order to build a Jewish-themed park on their land. Those Palestinians haven't engaged in violence. There are no rockets being fired in the West Bank. Not one single rocket has ever been fired. And where is this so-called international community to defend those Palestinians? The only conclusion many reasonable Palestinians could come to is that if we don't defend ourselves, no one will do it. The easiest thing to do is to stand up and to condemn people who engage in violence. Nobody likes violence. The much harder thing to do is to provide an alternative. And that's what I would argue we have to do. Instead of condemning people, instead of denouncing people who are defending themselves with limited means, provide them with an alternative. If there was a world, if there were governments willing to step in and impose an arms embargo on Israel, to step in and defend Palestinians who are under attack, under occupation, there would be no need for any kind of violence. If there was a world that was willing to step in and enforce international law, there would be no need for any kind of violence. But we have seen that despite the strong international consensus that Norman indicated, the balance of power in the world is that the governments that matter don't allow international law to be enforced, so it falls to international civil society. This is why, in 2005, Palestinians across the political spectrum, hundreds of Palestinian organizations called for an international campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions modeled on the anti-apartheid campaign. And 4 years later, this has really taken off. It's really incredible. I think it surprised a lot of people. Because at the beginning, people said, oh, you'll never get it. It will never reach the stage of South Africa, which was such a popular cause. You had celebrities, everyone willing to stand up for boycott, divestment, and sanctions of South Africa. And people say, it'll never happen. It'll never happen. Well, they've forgotten something. The first call, the first South African call to the world for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the apartheid regime came in 1958. It took until the 1980s for that to become mainstream. It took, does anyone know the first international artist, musician, who refused to play in apartheid South Africa? And she was derided and ridiculed by her peers. It was Dusty Springfield. And that was in the 1960s. But until the 1980s, it was not mainstream. Now, just 4 years after the Palestinian call, it's already going mainstream. In Europe, it is. And we've seen across universities, trade unions, across Europe, in Canada, in Australia. We've seen at sporting events. This is very similar to apartheid South Africa. When South African teams used to come and play in Europe, they would not allow any fans, because the protests would be so great. They had to play fixtures, matches, in empty stadiums. Well, an Israeli team just played its first fixture. I can't remember, was it in Sweden? What was the sport? I'm not a sports fan. I don't even remember the sport. I remember the politics, but not the sport. Was it Davis Cup? Tennis. Yeah, to an empty stadium. They had to play to an empty stadium, because the anticipation was that the protests would be so great. Even in this country, we see the first real glimmers of a widespread boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. People are very scared of this. They say, "Well, boycott is, you know, is a scary word," but they forget that it has a long and venerable history in this country. The Montgomery bus boycott, who every child learns about in civics class. Nobody says it was discriminatory against white run segregating bus companies for Rosa Parks and her comrades to boycott the buses. They say it was a right, just, non-violent form of resistance against an unjust system. An alternative to violence that was met with dogs and fire hoses and church bombings and National Guard troops to enforce segregation that was met with violence. We also can pose it in another way. Just a few years ago, hundreds of university presidents in this country signed a letter sent around by pro-Israel lobby groups saying that academic boycott of Israel is completely wrong and we will never support it, and we support academic freedom. All very well and good, fine, I support academic freedom too. But we can go to our university presidents and we can ask them to sign a letter that upholds Palestinian academic freedom against the bombing of universities, against the blockade of Gaza, which prevents students from traveling, scholars from traveling, which prevents now paper, glue, and ink for the printing of school books to enter Gaza. What about the academic freedom of Palestinians in the West Bank who can't travel from home to their universities or to outside the country for conferences, who can't bring their colleagues in? Let's demand that our universities uphold the academic freedom of Palestinians with the same vigor that they were in terms of Israel. Now, finally, we really have to challenge the hypocrisy of the so-called international community, the self-appointed international community, which includes the United States, Europe, and a few, and Canada and Australia, the Anglo-Saxons and the Europeans. Nobody else is part of the international community. Now, we see this extremist and transigent Israeli government lurching ever further to the right, coming to the power. Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, now the envoy of the Western powers, was asked the other day on Al Jazeera, you know, how will we deal with an Israeli government that is opposed to a two-state solution, that is opposed to peace? He said, we have to work with whoever the Israeli people elect. Let's test it out. Let's not just assume it won't work. Well, you know, unless Palestinians are really an inferior race, why doesn't the same logic apply to them? Their leaders were never given a chance. We have to demand that they are. I've exceeded my time by 30 seconds, so I'm going to take 30 more and say the following. That, you know, we may argue, and Norman and I sometimes disagree about one state or two states, or that really is not the issue fundamentally. The issue fundamentally is equality. The Israeli claim, the reason Israel cannot abide by international law is because to end the occupation, to allow the right of return, to obey Security Council resolutions, threatens a system in which Israeli Jews maintain for themselves a monopoly on economic, political, social, environmental, and other rights. Palestinian rights, which include full equality, the right of return, an end to occupation, don't threaten Israelis. They don't threaten Israelis. What they threaten is Israeli privileges. And that is what should be threatened and dismantled. And Palestinians are often told, well, if we give you a state in the West Bank or bits of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, then you must give up your right of return. No. Palestinians, like anyone else, should not be forced to choose among their human rights. They're entitled to all of their human rights. If I ask you, choose between your freedom of speech, your freedom of movement, your freedom of religion, you can pick one. You would say, no, I'm entitled to all of them. And that's what Palestinians say. Their rights don't threaten anyone else's rights. They only threaten other people's illegitimate privileges. And that's a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Abu Nahmah.